subcommittee of the House Water Committee. Date today, March 7th. And we will begin by looking at House, we'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2130. And this is Department's bill, Department of State Lands, John Lilly. Yes, please. Is that yours or John's writing?
It's Mark's scribble, sorry.
Okay. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Thank you, Chair Jensen, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Ann Hannis, Director, Department of State Lands. With me also is John Lilly, who's the Assistant Director of State Lands, and Janet Moreland, who's in charge of the Wetlands Program. John and I will make a few remarks, and Janet's also here to answer any technical questions and any other questions related to the program. Let me just summarize what House Bill 2130 does. It increases fees for certain removal fill permits. It sets new fees for other removal fill operations. It also sets fees for the first time for services that have previously, that are currently being provided at no cost to the applicant by the department. It does provide for increasing fees by 3% per year beginning in the year 2007. It does waive permit fees for habitat restoration projects and make some housekeeping changes. There's five reasons I'd like to put forward for supporting this bill. One, it equalizes the program support through permit fees and fees for service. Currently, only those paying for individual permits pay a fee for the program, and increasingly we're having more general authorizations, which are essentially an expedited way of getting a removal fill permit, as well as there's no fee for emergency authorizations. Further, if you want to have a wetland delineation report reviewed by staff, which is important when going through the process or to avoid wetlands, there's no fee for that. And we would be putting forth in this bill that there would be a fee for that. Secondly, it increases the level of user support from fees. Currently, fees only cover about 15 to 20% of the cost of the program. The remainder of it comes from revenues that would otherwise go into the Common School Fund. These are revenues from the use primarily of the lease and use of state-owned submerged and submersible lands. 2130 would cover about 30%, bump that up to about 30% of the cost from fees. Now, the last time that the fee was increased was in 1987, and at that time it was 40% of the cost of the program. And when the program was originally established in 1967, the fees covered two-thirds of it. Third, this allows for, as I mentioned with the Common School Fund, it allows for more revenue from other department sources to support our schools through the Common School Fund. So that means that more sand and gravel royalties and revenues from the lease and use of state-owned waterways.
Excuse me. We're going to open the full committee of the House Water Committee today, March 7th, and continue with a public hearing on House Bill 2130.
Great. Thank you. So more sand and gravel royalties and revenues would go into the Common School Fund in a time when schools need the money more than ever. I think this is important, and in the end, it would boost distributions to schools. Fourth, it provides funding for better service. One of the things that we've heard is that people want to have quicker review of wetland delineations. This new jurisdictional determination fee would raise enough money to fund a wetland specialist position, and that means that the reports would be reviewed in a more timely manner. This is really important, particularly if you want to have an economic development project proceed quickly so that you can get that done. Fifth, it rewards habitat restoration proponents in erosion control projects by waiving individual permit fees. So they would be exempt from paying fees. And lastly, after talking with our technical advisory committee about the best way to do it, they suggested in terms of increasing the fees, the best way to do it would be to look at it in terms of the inflation costs from 1987 to 2005. So with that, let me turn it over to John Lilly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. John Lilly, Assistant Director with the Department of State Lands. I'd like to get into a little bit more detail on what the bill encompasses. House Bill 2130 updates the removal fill program schedule of permit fees and establishes fees for certain jurisdictional determination services. Also makes some housekeeping changes in the removal fill law, but I want to focus primarily on the fee provisions of the bill, and particularly want to draw your attention to one of the new provisions that we're asking to be established is a fee for what we call jurisdictional determinations or wetland determination reports. They come in under various names. A particular note is this new fee because it allows for the applicant or a proponent to request for review and concurrence of one of their wetland delineation reports. Private consultants usually conduct these reports and conduct this delineation work. The reports can be very complex, covering large areas of property, and doing the report and reviewing the wetland delineations require education and training in soils, plant identification, hydrology, and specific training in wetland delineation procedures. The reports are also used to document the location of other jurisdictional waters, such as streams or ordinary high water on certain properties. Often a property owner will hire a consultant to conduct the jurisdictional determination to find out if there are waters on a property that are subject to either the state's removal fill law and the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers Section 404 permitting under the Clean Water Act. Sometimes local governments require these reports to be approved by our department before allowing a property to be developed under a local government permit. Concurrence from the Department of State Lands provides certainty to a developer. If they know where the wetlands are, they can design the project sometimes to avoid the wetland altogether and therefore avoid requiring a permit or obtaining a permit. Or sometimes they're able to choose a design for their development that minimizes impact on the wetland and therefore decreases their cost to comply with the state and federal law. Currently, the department reviews about 500 of these reports per year at no cost to the applicant. And currently, the agency is absorbing the cost of providing this service. And in recent years, despite our best efforts and a very dedicated staff, the department staff have fallen behind in giving timely review to these reports. The workload has grown faster than our ability to keep up. Consultants, property owners, local governments, and staff are all frustrated about the backlog, and I can only tell you that we get a number of calls from consultants and their clients and local government folks desiring to have these reports reviewed so they can get certainty into their development planning and construction processes, and then in many cases comply with the requirements of local government. And we would like to be able to provide this service in a more timely way, and we believe we could were we able to obtain a fee for this service and be able to hire at least one additional staff person to augment the staff that we currently have. Consultants tell us that their clients are willing to pay a fee for this service if they have reasonable assurance of timely response. The proposed wetland report review and concurrence fee of $325 will help DSL be more timely. The new fee is expected to raise about $195,000 per biennium and will finance an additional position, a wetland specialist that Ann spoke of and I spoke of earlier. In addition, House Bill 2130 allows for the department to set up an expedited process for an additional fee to review reports when the applicant wants a quicker response than the prioritization schedule that we establish. I should mention that the wetland consultant community and the removal fill technical advisory committee that advises us have all been interested in this particular aspect of this bill. And there have been, we have drafted amendments to clarify some of the issues. And I know that speakers who will come after us from the consultant community have some ideas about how to fine-tune the language that's in the current bill. And I think
that we have those amendments that you've drafted.
Pardon me, sir?
Do we have those amendments that you've drafted?
Yes, you do, sir.
Thank you.
The amendments that may be put forward by others who will speak to you today, we do not have copies of those amendments at this point.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I have a question.
Please.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Ann, I think this should be directed towards you. It was somewhat puzzling to me that currently the current fees only cover 15% to 20% of the program costs, and with this House Bill 2130, it would cover about 30%. Why wouldn't you charge enough to cover all of the costs of that?
Chair Jensen, Representative Tomei, I think we've been trying to get an increase for quite a while, so we're trying to do what we think might be feasible. I think over time it would be good to have a higher, but I think we're trying to get what we can and what
this
we think would be
supportable. This is somewhat perplexing to me, Mr. Chair, when we're looking for funds for education, and what we're doing is, because people don't have to pay what it actually costs the department to do these studies, then we're taking money from the common school fund. Am I understanding that correctly?
That's a perfectly legitimate question, and one that we probably will pursue in a little more.
Thank you. Thank you, Ann.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, may I proceed?
Please.
Good. Thank you. The removal of field permit fees is where I'd like to focus at this point. Another aspect of 2130 is the permit fees, and currently permit fees are assessed only for individual removal for field permits. As Ann has said, the last fee adjustment was made in 1987. These permits, the individual removal field permits, represent about 17% to 23% of the total workload that we encounter from the permit activity. Currently, there are two other types of permits: general authorizations, which are an expedited type of permit, and emergency authorizations, which are self-explanatory. They're issued in emergency situations. Both of those types of permits, emergency authorizations and general authorizations, are issued at no cost to the applicant under the current law. These permit types account for anywhere from 70% to 80% of our total workload, the majority of that being general authorizations. 2130 would increase the individual permit fee and the renewal fee, and the proposed new fee shown in House Bill 2130 was derived by adjusting the 1987 fee value that you see in current law by 3% per year over the 18-year period extending from 1987 to 2005. This would raise an additional, the text says $502, but it's actually $508,000 that would be raised in addition to what we currently raise, which is in the neighborhood of $400,000 or so. Fees for individual permits, for erosion control projects, and for habitat restoration projects would be waived. Currently, many the erosion control projects are waived, fees are waived by law, and since there's no fee for general authorizations, some of that work is done without fee. The bill would allow us to charge for emergency authorizations at the same rate as if they were qualifying for individual permit or general authorization. Let me give you a couple of examples that deal with individual removal field permits. In example A, a property owner builds a bridge and a road and removes about 200 cubic yards of material from a stream. Currently, they pay $50 with no fee for volume. And under House Bill 2130, they would pay $85, again, with no volume fee for that removal. Under example B, the development of a shopping center requiring 50,000 cubic yards of fill in a wetland, the fee currently is $375. The fee under House Bill 2130 would be $625. In addition, a provision of the bill would allow for the individual removal fill fee to be increased at 3% per year starting in 2007. And the general authorizations, this type of expedited permit that represents far, again, the majority of our workload, we would we're asking that under this legislation that we would be able to set the fee administratively by rule, but not to exceed $250. We anticipate just about $100,000 of new revenue from that fee if we were able to institute that. And then finally, overall, 2130 anticipates a gross increase in revenue in excess of $500,000 and would increase the amount of program support coming from fees and services to about 30% of program costs. Thank you, and I'd be willing to take any questions.
Representative Domingue.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. John, so the two examples that you gave us, what is that, what are actually the costs for those two permits?
In the last few months, of course, we've been looking at this matter quite closely, and as we did in the prior session in 2003 when we put forward legislation of the same nature. It appears as if, depending on how you do the bookkeeping, it looks like the cost of issuing a permit is somewhere in the neighborhood of $1,500 to $2,000. Now, that doesn't count. We took a very narrow view in doing that. We looked at the cost of processing a permit. Did not include the cost of some of the work that is done by Ms. Moreland's unit in the wetland section or in our compliance monitoring and enforcement section or that workload. So I think that figure is very much on the low side. Exactly what it is beyond that, I'm not sure how to bracket it beyond that. But I would think a educated guess is in the neighborhood of $1,500 to $2,000 for a processing permit, possibly a little bit more depending on the kind of permit we deal with and if we include another aspect of the program, which is enforcement, into the costs.
Follow-up, please?
Follow-up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So would that cost be for both of those permits, the shopping center as well as the bridge and road?
Mr. Chair, Representative Tomei, yes, that number I gave you is on the very low side of what the cost would be for those. In some cases, unfortunately, all permits are not the same, and the amount of effort needed to process a permit is not always uniform. If a permit project becomes quite controversial or involves a lot of entities, the federal government, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, or National Marine Fisheries Science, or Fisheries Service, the cost can rise because the amount of effort needed to process the permit increases. As the controversy increases, so does the amount of cost.
Thank you, John. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any other questions?
Mr. Chair.
Yes. Go ahead.
Barnard.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, to some extent, this is a follow-up, I think, on Representative Tomei's questions. We're setting these fees in these sections of the statute at absolute dollar amounts. The last time this was addressed apparently was 18 years ago. Has there been any thought given to establishing them in some way other than in absolute dollar amounts so that they can be adjusted as the cost of processing them or inflation or something else changes? It's, and the reason I ask the question is it strikes me that every 18 years is probably not often enough to address the question I just asked.
Chair Jensen, Representative Barnhart, I think there's a couple approaches that could be taken. One is just to provide authority to the agency to set those fees based on cost or to do it based on certain criteria, rulemaking. That's one way to do it. There have been, DEQ, for example, has authority where it recovers its costs for issuing different permits. That's another way to do it as well.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative Barnhart, I would point out, as Ann has as well, is that the bill does include a 3% per year adjustment for the individual permit fee beginning in 2007. So there is an aspect of what you suggest in House Bill 2130.
Thank you. I missed that.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Cromwell.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Couple of questions. Again, relative to the fees. The fee was adjusted by figuring 3% per year over 18 years, and then you testified that in the bill starting in 2007 it's going to increase by 3% per year. Why didn't you tie this to the CPI? Why did you go with a flat 3% rate when we have a CPI that's at 1.92 and 2.4%? It seems like it's a little heavy-handed to just set it at a flat 3%.
Chair Jensen.
If I may add, Mr. Cromwell, when CPI hits 12%, as it has in some of my life history, it's a little inadequate.
That's correct.
Yes.
Chair Jensen, Representative Cromwell, I think the chair hit it precisely, is that we were trying to do an average of what inflation has been over time, so we just put in 3%. Certainly, a CPI index or linking it to some index could be another approach that we'd be open to.
Well, Mr. Chair, if I may, and excuse me for sort of sounding facetious, but when you put it that way, it sort of sounds like what I would refer to as a PFA number. And PFA stands for plucked from air. Maybe I'm being just a little bit too flippant, and I don't mean to be, but I think that it gives you a more of a basis for the increase if you do tie it to the CPI. And as the chair pointed out, when the CPI is up at 12% or 9%, then the fee increase is going to be more adequate. But when it's under 3%, when it's down around 1.92 and that sort of thing, it still makes it adequate to make sure that the fees being collected are actually going to cover the expenses of the program. And sort of along that same line, if I may, Mr. Chair, with another question, is that when we're looking at these fee increases, are the fees for this only statutorily, and I didn't see it in the bill here, only statutorily supposed to cover the cost of administering the program, or is there supposed to be profits, not quite the right word to use, but proceeds, let's say put it that way, are there supposed to be additional proceeds that then go to the Common School Fund and that it's supposed to support or grow the Common School Fund, or is it just supposed to pay for the administration of the program?
Chair Jensen, Representative Cromwell, well, currently the fees cover less than 20% of the program, and even with this fee increase, it would only take it to 30, so there's still quite a ways to go there. The intent for fees would be to cover just the cost of the program, and I think originally there was some portion of the program that wasn't covered by fees, and the reason that it wasn't covered by fees was a recognition that the state owns some of the waterways and that those waterways benefit the Common School Fund, and hence there was some public share there that was appropriate. However, the reason why we're coming forward with this fee increase is because we think that somewhere between 15 to 20% is really, you know, too low in terms of the share that should be borne by the user as opposed to the share borne by the Common School Fund.
Okay. And one last question, if I may, Mr. Chair. Is this with regards to the performance measures of the agency, is this program a part of that in terms of making with regards to your performance, and is this fee increase something that is going to enhance the ability of the department to reach their performance measures?
Chair Jensen, Representative Cromwell, we have a number of performance measures related to the removal fill program, and we spent quite a bit of time going through those performance measures with the Natural Resource Committee. What this will really help us with in terms of the performance of the agency is by being able to increase the timeliness in which we review and approve wetland delineations And that's something we really hear strongly, as John Lilly mentioned, because if you're an applicant and you're wanting to do a project, it could be very important as you're planning out, say, a subdivision of housing or a commercial complex. If you know where the wetlands are, you can plan exactly where the footprint is of that building, avoid the wetlands, and be able to proceed either avoiding the whole removal fill permitting process entirely or knowing how to minimize that. And if you can be able to get that review done very quickly, then you can, time is money. You can get that project done. So in the context of the fee that we're charging here, we think it's a pretty small part of what a commercial development or subdivision cost would be to allow them to get their project done in a much more timely way. So very much so it's linked to the performance of the agency and the program itself.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Dingell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a couple more technically oriented questions that I thought I might as well ask you guys while you're up here. And I was glad to see the amendment, because when I first read the bill, I was a little concerned, because as far as I knew, we didn't regulate hydric soils, but wetlands and waters of the state. So I see that you've corrected that in Section 2 with the amendment. But I have a couple of questions that are more technical in nature and just clarification. If you could bear with me here for a minute. One is on page 6. At the top of page 6, it's section 5, sub E2, and it states a public body, as defined in ORS 174.09, may not issue a lease or permit contrary or in opposition to the conditions set in the permit issued under ORS. And the question I had, would this preclude a local government from regulating wetlands more stringently than the state? And I don't know if I was just reading that wrong, or if you can help me in clarifying that interpretation. And I saw we had legal counsel somewhere, so I thought he was hiding in the back.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dingfelder, I've not spent a lot of time perusing that particular part of the statute. I'd like to be able to come back to you with a direct answer to your question.
Okay. I'd also like to note that on page 3, I think one of the things that legislative council did was define a person, and a person also includes a public body as defined in ORS 174-109.
Okay. So, yeah, I'd like clarification on that, because it wasn't clear to me if a local jurisdiction had, a stricter wetland ordinance, if that would be precluded. And you can come back. The second point, if I may, was on Section 7 of the under Sub 1. And there's a lot of language that was taken out, and now it just reads, a person who is required to have a permit to remove material from the bed or banks to fill any waters of the state shall file a written application, blah, 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 blah. And then it says, for each discrete project. So the question is, how is discrete project defined? And, hypothetically, would somebody who is building, doing fill and removal and have multiple stages, would they need more than one permit? And again, it wasn't clear to me by reading the statute how that would apply.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dingfelder, discrete project is not defined in the proposed legislation. Discrete project has a kind of a rule of thumb or an art term of art in the type of regulating business that we're involved in. A project is the removal fill project, and there may be multiple aspects of a discrete project. For example, the shopping center that I described. Oftentimes, it's not as simple as just one fill in a wetland. It may be a fill in a stream, and it may be a fill in another wetland for another aspect of the project, but altogether, that is the discrete project.
Okay, just follow up for clarification.
Follow-up.
So you could have one permit that would cover all aspects of that project. The applicant wouldn't have to come back for multiple times, or would it be conditioned that, throughout the life of the project, or how would that work?
Mr. Chair, Representative Dingfelder, it would be up to the applicant as to how they wanted to phase the project. It is not unusual to see a project come in with a phase one and a phase two. We have in the past approved projects, of a phase one, a phase two, phase three nature, but they're not an applicant's not bound to do that. I think that it is more, in our view, it is better if the applicant puts on the table at the front end everything that they know that they think they will be doing on a property to complete a project. But again, it is the prerogative of the applicant as to how they want to sequence their work.
Okay. And I have one final question, Mr. Chair. And I'll wait to hear back from you as far as the whether the preemption applies. Regarding the jurisdictional determination fee, which actually I'm very supportive because for years I've thought it's sort of been crazy that you guys haven't charged, especially having worked on the consulting end and seeing all the technical assistance that you give to consultants who are making a living off of this. I think it's about time, personally. One of the things I would be very interested to see, if you could give us some information on what other states are charging, for instance, Department of Ecology in Washington or DNR in California, if they are charging a fee, how does this, the fee that you're proposing, is that in line with what other states have? And I realize that every state has different programs, but many of them do wetland delineation. And then does the Corps charge a fee currently for reviewing wetland delineation reports?
I'm going to ask Janet to answer that question.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Janet Moreland. I'm the Wetlands Program Manager at the Department of State Lands. No, the Corps does not have a separate fee for wetland delineation review. The Corps does not do in advance reviews like the Department of State Lands does. As Ann articulated really well, a lot of people really want to get an initial hit on whether or not the wetlands on their property are accurately mapped, and we try to do that as far in advance as possible so that they can go through their local permitting process, for example, and know what they're dealing with. The Corps of Engineers, for the last about 8 or 9 years, has declined to do that kind of an advance review. They will review the delineation along with the permit application.
Okay, thank you.
I represent Tony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, I guess this is directed more towards you. I'm assuming that we'll be understanding more why the fees do not cover the true costs.
Right.
Is that true?
Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you. And Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was busy looking up some of the underlying statutes to try to get a better sense of to orient myself around this bill, and I think that if we're going to get more information later about in response to the question that Representative Tomei just asked, I may put off asking further questions about it now. It does strike me as odd, at least, that the common school fund would be used to subsidize any portion of the processes we're talking about, and it may just be that I'm missing some important point. And if that's coming up later, I'll wait.
Okay. Thank you, Representative. Go ahead.
I was going to say I could respond to that just briefly, if you'd like me to.
Briefly.
Okay. The originally, because the land board has jurisdiction over common school fund lands, which includes the waterways of the state, it used to be before there was even a program to need permission for doing any kind of work, and state waterways had to come before the land board. And there is a certain portion of the waterways that are state owned. So that's how the link was to the common school fund. And the Common School Fund gets revenues from those waterways, such as from sand and gravel leasing, marinas, houseboats, that kind of thing.
If I may, I understand the link you've made. What I don't understand is why the Common School Fund should subsidize these processes that we're talking about collecting fees for. That's the part I don't understand. I mean, if we own an asset which is designed to produce income for the common school fund, I'm having trouble understanding why we would subsidize other operations that are going on in connection with that asset.
I think you've hit on the head why we're coming here with our fee bill.
Okay. I just have a couple of quick questions. In Section 2, 3A, That is a typo error, isn't it? Where you say the department may, you really meant to say will, didn't you?
What was the line?
Right there. Right there. May.
Section 2, 3, 8.
Mr. Chair, I think you're referring to on line 22. It says the department may waive the fee requirement and return all or portion if.
Right.
Well, actually, I think we would prefer it to be permissive, but I think that.
I beg your pardon. I thought you said you would prefer it to be will.
Mr. Chair, this may be one of those mays that legislative council says is mandatory.
Expect an amendment on that when we come back on this. The second thing that you probably would want to expect on this bill, if you look at the relating clause, for the chair of the water committee, you would appreciate that's manna from heaven. So you probably wouldn't expect this bill to move until just before the committee closes. When I get a relating clause relating to waters of this state, I'm inclined to want to hang on to it. So I would not anticipate that it would move quickly through this side. Are there other questions? That's compliments of your friends in legislative council who have done that to you. Thank you very much. And we'll go to the top of the list then, and we have Tim Acker. Pardon me. And Chris from AOI, Association of AOC, excuse me. And, just two for now.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I believe in your packet on top you have some written testimony. And it is what I received via email from Mr. Acker. So.
Thank you. Good afternoon, gentlemen. Kim, I think first, if you would, please.
Well, thank you, Chairman Jensen, member of the committee. For the record, my name is Tim Acker, and I'm the owner of Applied Technology Wetland and Forestry Consultants in Albany. I've been a wetlands consultant for 8 years, and I'm here today to testify in support of House Bill 2130. I support the fee increase for three reasons. I think they're fair and that it embodies a philosophy of user pays. Theoretically, the fee increase should result in more money in the common school fund, and I think that's a good thing. And lastly, the fee increases are not significant when considered alongside the entire cost of a real estate development project today. Now, earlier, there's been a lot of talk about cost, and I just want to make the point that to my clients, the biggest cost with getting through the wetlands issues are time and uncertainty. It's not the fees. It's the uncertainty that are you going to get your permit, and it's the time that it takes to get the permit. So in particular, I support the fee for getting wetland delineations approved without having to attach them to a permit application. And the reason why that's so important is because as early as possible, the project proponents need to know where everyone agrees that the wetlands are so that the engineers can either avoid the wetland altogether with the project or that we can minimize the impact to the wetland. And the other reason why we need the flexibility to be able to come in and get a what we call a concurrence letter from the department at any time is we never know when the local jurisdictions are going to require that we have something from DSL stating that at least everyone agrees where the wetlands are at. Right now, we'll have projects that We may not intend on impacting any wetlands, but because of a local requirement, in order for their permits to go forward, we need to get something out of the division or the department stating that they concur with our delineation on where the wetlands are at. And the only timely way of doing that is to file basically a bogus permit application where we're requesting a no state permit required letter in order just to get them to review the delineation within 90 days. Now that is so inefficient, it should be obvious. We're putting burden on the wetland or the permit shop, which is a separate shop from the wetland shop, just to get through the process. It's not efficient for us and it's not efficient for the department. But right now, that's the state of play. The idea of how big the fees are and the numbers that John put out, I'd be willing to say, having talked this over with several of my larger clients, that even the cost, what we call the full freight, of paying the total cost of the program, would probably not be a deterrent to my clients given the scope of systems development charges and everything else that they face when they go in to do a project. Now, one thing I would say, however, is that if it does come to pass and we design something like that, a 500th of an acre wetland is going to be a different kettle of fish than half an acre of wetland, and a person is not going to want to be paying $5,000 for a permit to do the little one and then also for the large one. Right now, part of the problem with the program is that it's a one-size-fits-all. So having said all that, in the broader picture, I think, is what we're looking at is trying to get more resources for the wetlands program at DSL. And, you have the revenue side of that picture. There are also areas, I think, where they're tasked by the legislature to do things that experience has shown us now that the output of their effort is not worth what it's costing them to do. And two of those areas, I'll just give you for an example. One is the land use notification process. This is a process where there's a coordination link between the state and local government. When someone comes into a local jurisdiction with a project needing permits, the local jurisdiction will look at their maps and see whether there's hydric soil or whether there's wetlands on the local wetland inventory or the national wetland inventory. They'll send the applicant a letter. They'll also send a letter to DSL. DSL then goes through the same process and sends a letter to the applicant, sends a letter back to the local jurisdiction. Now, that process may take 15 minutes. It may take an hour. But they do it hundreds of times a year. And when you look at it, it's completely redundant. The local jurisdiction has already told the applicant that there may be wetlands on their project area. They may need permits. I don't see that DSL is adding any value by also doing the same thing. So my recommendation there would be that be one area to look at rationalizing. The second area is under the local wetland inventory process.
Question, Mr. Chair.
Question, Representative Byron.
Thank you. Just on the point you were just on.
Okay.
The DSL, if I understand what you're describing correctly, the DSL would never be in a position to make that assessment if it hadn't been alerted to it by the local jurisdiction having already made the assessment. Is that correct?
That's my understanding of it. But I guess what I'm recommending here is not so much that DSL not be informed, but that they not action it. They can put it in their database. But they don't have to go through the process of confirming that it's on the LWI, confirming it's on the NWI, which are the local wetland inventory maps and the national wetland inventory maps, confirming that there's hydric soils there, bundling that all up into a land use notification, sending that back to the applicant. The applicant already has enough information to know that something's here, maybe I better go get a consultant or something like, I need to action this, sir. Or they can say, no, there's no way there's a wetland here and I'm going forward with my project, and they run the risk then of being in violation of the law. But they do that now.
All right. If I may, just a quick follow-up. But the point I'm trying to get at is that the Division of State Lands would never be involved in this process at all if they hadn't been alerted by the letter from the local jurisdiction. And therefore, there would be nothing that would trigger the Department of State Lands action. but for the letter they received from the local jurisdiction. Am I right about that?
That's correct.
Thank you.
That's correct. But again, my point is that...
I understand
okay.
Your point. Thank you.
Okay. In regards to the local wetland inventory, just very quickly, the local wetland inventory is a local jurisdiction project. They pay for it. They hire the consultant who does the work. The state has already set very specific guidelines of how these inventories are supposed to be done. Given all that, and given the fact that currently DSL goes through two rounds of checking, which takes an enormous amount of time, if you know my conversations with staff are indicative, and the outcome, the output of these inventories is that they're notoriously inaccurate. My experience has been about one project in three, you're going to run into an inaccuracy where either the wetland they call is there is not there in reality. The wetland is there, but it's not in the same place. So they're very inaccurate given DSL's best efforts. Now, the kind of the quality control governor on the whole process is when the project is proposed on that tax lot, a delineation has to be done anyway, which trumps the local wetland inventory at the end of it all. So before any damage occurs, we have a check and balance, if you will. So my argument is that the effort that DSL is putting into doing those reviews is not commensurate with the quality of the output, and that we could accept the local wetland inventories as they are coming out of the local jurisdictions and refining them as we go without DSL having to have such an intensive and really staff-intensive input in the first place. So those are just two examples where I think we can look at squeezing more staff resources out of the wetlands program. Now, having said all that, I'm not saying that we should somehow trade that off against the fee increases. What I'd like to see are the fee increases and the rationalization of the staff tasking in order to get as much efficiency out of the wetlands program as we can. There's nothing I'd like more than be able to file a wetland delineation and get a concurrence letter back in 2 weeks or a month. So that's all I have. Any questions, I'd be happy to answer.
Thank you, sir. Please.
Chair Jensen and committee members, my name is Chris Baham. I'm the environmental coordinator with the County Road Program at the Association of Oregon Counties, and I'm speaking on behalf of the Oregon Association of County Engineers and Surveyors, or as I refer to them as OASIS by their acronym. I've submitted written testimony, and I'd like to say that county road departments submit a many number of permits during the course of a year, and we feel that it's appropriate that our permits be reviewed for their potential impact on sensitive resources, particularly wetlands and other sensitive resources. Although county road departments are never pleased with paying higher fees because it takes from the money we have available to do road work, we think that the passage of House Bill 2130 is certainly appropriate, and we support it. We feel that it would shift more of the burden on the users, such as us, which we believe where it should be, as opposed to the common school fund. That's pretty much where the OASIS members stand.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Thank you, gentlemen.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Tolman.
Thank you. Tim, in your first page, you said that the proposed fee increases are fair. Do you think it would be fair to pay the full cost of the studies?
I do.
Thank you.
Thank you, Jim. At this point, we have Dale Buck, I believe it is, and can I bring Glenn Stonebrick? We're going to try to move along here, and I don't mean to abbreviate your comments, but we may not have as many questions in light of my trying to move along with it.
Representative Jensen, Chair, and the House Water Committee, and the names I have on here, I apologize, there's been a change. I don't have Representative Tomei, I have Representative Schur. In reference to House Bill 2130, and first, my name is Dale Buck, and I live at 25590 Chinook Street, Cloverdale, Oregon, 97112, and I'm a retired Tillamook County dairy farmer. I oppose this bill for reasons that I don't necessarily have on my written testimony, but as has been a lot of the talk already today, the fees go to the Common School Fund to support the administration of ORS 196-600 and 196.905. I believe, and a lot of other landowners like myself believe, that if DSL would stop forcing landowners into court for attempting to protect their land, crops, roads, dikes, underground tile lines, and so forth, and then stop appealing judges' decisions once they've made it, there would be more dollars in the Common School Fund. The legislation adds a new fee that's been talked about a great deal. It adds 60% to the present fees. And then in line 2729 on page 10, it adds that 3%. And in the copy of the bill I have says nothing about 2007, which it doesn't make any difference. It's a small amount. The other thing that concerns us is the words rule and rules are used at least 8 times. And those words are always worrisome to those of us out on the land because rules are made after the legislation is passed, not before, and then we have to live with them. And then the last thing, section 20, line 24, 25, and 26 of page 21, declaring an emergency cannot possibly be a true statement, I don't think, with this kind of legislation. And I want to say that myself and some others, John Lilly of the Division of State Lands has given us 4 hours of his time. I didn't make much headway in my opinion, but I appreciate the fact that they gave us the time, and I'm sure there'll be more in the future too. But if there are any questions, I'd try to answer them.
Thank you. Glenn.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Glenn Stonebrink. I'm with the Oregon Cattlemen's Association. I think what we have to do is step back a little bit and take a look at what we're talking about here. We're talking about private property that the state has declared for the benefit of the public should remain as a wetland. So we've restricted the use of someone's property. And we've taken the value and use from that person without any compensation. Then we ask the person, if you want to do something with that land that the government has taken from you, get permission. And then we've charged them to get permission. And now we're asking to increase the fee to get permission to do something with your private property. I think the voters, when they voted on Measure 37, said something about private property and the government's taking of that private property. Now, as for paying for the full cost of implementing this program, 2 years ago, I introduced a bill which got absolutely nowhere that said perhaps we have too much government. We have the federal government regulating these wetlands, and on the exact same wetlands, we have the state government regulating the same wetland. The bill I had proposed last session was to ask for the state to step aside and not have that cost to the Common School Fund. In the Ways and Means Committee last session, there was the number $2.7 million of a loss or a charge against the Common School Fund because the fees weren't high enough. I don't know if that's accurate or anywhere close to that, but that's the number I recall. So I wish that the legislature would decide they have the will to reduce government and reduce cost at the same time. But in the meantime, we are totally opposed to increasing the fees, and this is no surprise to DSL. I told them that I opposed it 2 years ago and still oppose it on private property for public benefit who's received no compensation for their loss. Thank you.
Thank you, Glenn. Questions? Either gentleman?
Thank you.
Thank you very
Thank
much.
You.
Then we have Laurie Wimmer, Chuck Bennett, Laurie Wimmer Whalen, Chuck Bennett, and John Marshall. Good afternoon. You're first signed up, Laurie. Your turn.
All right. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and committee members. Good afternoon. For the record, Laurie Wimmer Whalen with the Oregon Education Association. May I say, OEA just doesn't get enough time to spend in front of water. That's great to be here. We're here.
That's a terrible mistake. See if we
I
can
think
correct
so.
It.
Hoping to rectify that today. We're here in support of 2130. As members of the Common School Fund Beneficiaries Coalition, just as a little review, we are alarmed to see the slippage in the rates. To remind you, 1967, two-thirds of the cost of the program was covered in the fees. By 20 years later, the last time it's been revised upward, 40% of the cost was covered in the fees. And now 15 to 20% of the cost is covered in the fees, and we'd like to see that go the other direction rather than continually sliding downward. I do not have any expertise in the removal fill program, so I'd appreciate it if you'd leave your technical questions for those who do. But we do believe that the Common School Fund, which provides distributions twice a year to school districts around the state, has been a valuable and increasing share of the total education funding pie. And so we support this as a way to help make management more efficient to maximize those dollars. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Chuck,
thank you. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Chuck Bennett. I represent the Confederation of Oregon School Administrators. We're here also in support of House Bill 2130. Same reasons that Lori just outlined, this slippage has been a longstanding concern. Our organizations have become increasingly concerned about the Common School Fund and the direction it's taking as we've watched this across the board. There are a whole variety of fees that don't cover the costs, and the outcome is just quite simply those costs that are not covered by the cost of the program are borne on the backs of the school children of Oregon. We view the Common School Fund, I think, increasingly as an important resource, and Mr. Marshall will go over that. Short of Mr. Stonebrink's proposal that would relieve you of any responsibility, as long as you're going to have responsibility and you're going to charge fees for these activities, we'd ask you to reverse the trend that Laurie outlined that went from 66% to 40% to now 15 or 20%. You have a fiduciary responsibility along with the State Land Board to this fund. This fund is being has been substantially overlooked. It's about to hit $1 billion. It's become a major resource. I think if we went back historically and members of this legislature historically 100 years ago had taken the kind of responsibility we're asking you to take today, we wouldn't be talking about all the other resources that we have to ask you for in trying to cover the cost of educating children in Oregon. But that's not what history has dealt us, and now it's your turn to sort of step up to the plate and we hope reverse this really unfortunate trend in having the Common School Fund be the subsidizer of a variety of natural resource industries. Thank you.
Thank you, Chuck.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, good afternoon. John Marshall, representing the Oregon School Boards Association. And I notice in one of the handouts provided by the Department of State Lands, I think lays out pretty clearly exactly what would happen should this bill not pass. First is the Common School Fund, as Representative Barnhart suggested, will carry a disproportionate share of the support for this removal fill program. And we believe that subsidizing this program on the backs of Oregon school kids is wrong. Secondly, it talks about that property owners and developers will receive their delineation reports in a more timely manner and suggests that some economic development projects will be delayed if this bill isn't passed. So I would suggest that this bill represents both a school funding as well as an economic development measure. And when you can package two of those important issues into one, it's certainly, in our view, worthy of your support. Thank you.
Thank you. Question? Comment? appreciate you taking the time to come before this lowly committee as you all spend your time over in more rarefied environments.
We have our money here.
Mr. Chair, it's been a much more pleasant experience, I think, than any of us envisioned, and we'll certainly come back again.
Okay, very good. We'll cease with that so we don't get too big a trouble. I have two more people to speak on this, Mike Stewart and Phil Scholes. And we have Mike Stewart first.
I'll let Phil go first, if that's okay.
That's fine.
Thank you. Representative Jensen and members of the committee, my name is Phil Scholes. I'm a consulting soil scientist, and I'm also a wetland consultant. I do a lot of work on the west side of the state with the DSL permitting, and so this bill is sort of close to heart on me. I support this bill for many of the reasons you've already heard from the other consultant. I've read through his testimony, and I pretty much support it. There are some things that I would like to mention about some of the wording in the bill that would maybe like to add in the record, and I have talked at least informally with DSL about some changes. Some of it has to just do with some of the language. In our industry, we just simply refer to our reports as delineation reports. They've got a wetland jurisdictional determination report, a little more wordy. I'm just sort of suggesting language to just call it exactly what the industry calls it, which is a delineation report. Similarly, they refer to a letter that they respond to reports with as a wetland jurisdictional delineate or determination, and in the industry, we pretty much refer to it as a concurrence letter or a concurrence report or a jurisdictional determination, something a little lighter. The provisions on in Section 2 on page 1, starting with line 24, where they may provide an expedited review, I think that what I'd like to suggest is that they may provide a expedited review. My concern about this department providing expedited reviews is that people submit reports sometimes months in advance of their project, and to have someone come in for an additional fee and cut in line and get their report done because they can afford it, I think is sort of unfair to the people that have already submitted their stuff. It's easy for a developer to write a check for twice the amount or three times the amount of what a normal report review might cost, but to somebody that's been waiting 4 months, they shouldn't be put aside. So I think that the language here which should be that they may provide it, and that the fee that they charge would be determined by the supplemental cost to the department, and that would be presumably determined annually through their rulemaking or something like that.
Mr. Chair, may I ask a question?
Go ahead, Representative Coleman.
Okay. Would you also have trouble with this if they hired extra people to service the expedited reports?
That would be all right with me, although I tend to believe that the department has internal resources to review this stuff if they were looking at other means of it being efficient with their time. Mm-hmm. That additional staff wouldn't be necessary. It's just some realignment of responsibilities.
Thank you.
It would be nice to have someone that is dedicated to review stuff. If it's an expedited review, I think that should be sort of a done above and beyond sort of their normal time allotment or something like that.
Thanks.
In the bill, there is some language that's been around for years, probably from the very beginning. I should say the existing law, I'm sorry, dealing with their fee schedule. And their fee schedule is outlined on page, pretty much begins on page, at bottom of page 7, goes on 8, 9, and so on. They have probably one of the most complicated ways of describing how to pay for the permits. They have a base fee, and then they have an application fee, and then they have a fee based on the volume, and then they have it the redundant rates for private operators, commercial operators, and public entities. Frankly, I think these could all be simplified into a flat rate for a removal or a flat rate for a fill application based on the volume. and essentially two or three pages of the law could be reduced down to one paragraph. I did talk to the department about this, and I guess, you know, it's sort of like if it ain't broke, don't fix it. And I thought it would just be worth at least adding to the discussion that there is an opportunity here to make it a lot simpler if the committee is interested in doing that. The final line of the bill on page 21, section 21, refers to a date of July 1st, 2005, and I don't know if the committee would like to consider putting in something like 90 days after the either the legislature adjourns or after it's signed in the law, simply because I don't know if the legislature will still be here or camping out here after July 1st. So I know that last session it was a long time for you folks. Other than that, I would like to respond to something that Representative Dingfelder had mentioned about precluding the law language here, precluding local governments from taking on more strict language. And the law as it exists now defines what methodology must be used for wetland delineation. So the cities and counties and such don't have the opportunity to come up with a different standard of what defines a wetland, what doesn't. But there are actually a number of different counties and cities that have adopted regulations that have required setbacks from wetlands that are not required at the state level. There are the Clean Water Services Agency up in Washington County has some of their own people reviewing delineation reports because of their local needs of having these reviews done in sometimes a matter of weeks. And so there is actually precedents already in place that more restrictive things by counties and cities are in effect, and no one has had concerns that it's conflicting with the statute at this time. And the last thing is there are a lot of little housekeeping changes in the bill, changing the words or the arrangement of some of the words. And I've talked to the department about this, and they've assured me that the little changes in some of the semantics is not changing the meaning of the law. And so I will take their word on that. But I would mention the one word that I did catch or caught my attention is on page 2 near the bottom, line 41, 42, and 44. It changes the word impact to effect. And I understand that this is done to make consistency with other aspects of the law, but technically speaking, an impact refers to something that is directly happening, and effect can actually encompass secondary impacts. And I guess if I were given a choice, I wouldn't actually use the word effect. I would just leave the statute as it is, as impact. But I do understand the rationale why legislative council made that change. I think that's the bulk of my comments.
Okay. Thank you. Mr. Stewart.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Mel Stewart. First of all, I'd like to just identify some agreement I have with DSL, and that's the Common School Fund. Regulatory programs of any kind should never be funded out of the Common School Fund. Never should have happened in the first place. I direct your attention to the Oregon Constitution, a reading of the Common School Fund discussion in the Oregon Constitution. Inappropriate to be running regulatory programs out of the Common School Fund. That money should all go to school children. Next of all, I'd like to remind the committee that we have a three-layer regulatory process here. For a person like myself that goes to get a permit, I've got to get three permits. I've got to get a Corps of Engineers permit, I've got to get a DSL permit, and I've got to get a local government permit. That local government permit is issued subject to a comprehensive planning process that was created in 1973. And part of that comprehensive planning process is Goal 5 compliance, which includes wetlands. identification of significant wetlands, identification of non-significant wetlands. What should be happening here is properties that are identified for development within an acknowledged comprehensive plan with Goal 5 compliance, that permit should be available to the property owner at the local level without DSL issuing any permit whatsoever. DSL does not need to be involved in the regulatory process. You have the Corps of Engineers. You have local local government acting pursuant to an acknowledged comprehensive plan with full Goal 5 compliance. Once the city, local government, has stepped through all those hoops to have Goal 5 compliance, they should be able to issue the permit with the Corps of Engineers overseeing it. And as a double check to the process, you don't need a second permitting process here. Next of all, in my personal experience going through trying to get a permit from DSL, to go through the permit process twice, got denied both times, took 12 years. 12 years in the permitting process. One of the things DSL wanted for my 2 acres of land was about $350,000 worth of mitigation. $350,000 on a piece of property worth $178,000. $178,000. More than twice the value of the property, mitigation. It doesn't matter what the permit fee is at that point in time. It's a total taking of your land.
Mr. Short, I believe we had a rather lengthy discussion, meetings, hearings on this issue 2 years ago, didn't we? So could we move on just to the things that are germane to this particular bill, please?
Okay. Three out of every, we reviewed for a 5-year segment 619 DSL wetlands permits. Three out of every 4 DSL permits are less than a half an acre in size, average quarter acre in size. So the impression that was left, by the previous witnesses is that we're talking about shopping centers. Well, we're not talking about shopping centers. We're talking about little property owners. And those are paying the burden of this entire regulatory program. And it makes it so they just can't use their land, period.
Okay. I think that's it. Thank you, Mr. Stewart. Appreciate all of your testimony and on this. As we have indicated, there are some amendments that we will be looking at. We're sure the department has one more amendment at least that they'll be bringing to us. With that, we're going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2130, and I'm going to open a work session for the introduction of committee bills and our bills, if you would do that, Sandy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, you should have in your packet LC 3213, dated February 14, 2005. It's creating a task force on water distribution. It establishes the membership and outlines the objective of the task force, and it does put a requirement on the task force to report to the next legislative assembly, and it has a sunset date, and it declares an emergency.
Sandy?
Do we have another one?
We don't happen to have copies of this.
3213
is the bottom of the pile. Right underneath.
I looked through everything. I didn't have one.
Did you get one representative?
I don't know.
Yeah.
No.
I'm less efficient in filing. Therefore, it was on the bottom of the file.
Yeah,
it was
underneath everything. It was last on the agenda.
Okay.
Do you need them to treat somewhere?
As you know, this introduction of a committee bill, the chair would entertain a motion. Representative Cromwell.
Chair, Mr. Chair, I'll move LC 3213 be introduced as a committee bill.
Thank you, Representative. Before we ask for your yes, no's, or okays or not, would once again like to remind members of the committee that approval of this being introduced as a committee bill in no way obligates you to any course of action in the future. You may oppose it, you may support it,
when it comes time to be heard. It's just merely to get the bill in the process. Is there any objection to introducing it? So ordered. We have no one. Okay. We'll close then the work session, and we will open a public hearing on House Bill 2130. 2265. And again, we have the Department of State Lands, Mr. Lilly, and there's Jeff. Please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, I'm John Lilly, Assistant Director with the Department of State Lands. This bill comes before you as a measure that was crafted by the Legislative Council, and is similar to a provision that is incorporated into a bill that's over on the Senate side, Senate Bill 170, which has already had a hearing in the Environment Committee there. Initially, we viewed this bill as a housekeeping measure. How many times have you heard that this session, I'm sure? But on reflection, and after hearing from a number of folks who are concerned about the measure, a number of folks have raised concerns about the provisions in the bill, and that we're no longer, the department, that is no longer supporting the portion of Senate Bill 170 that deals with this measure, nor are we at this time interested in moving this bill forward.
Mr. Lilly, for the information, the chair's intention is to offer an amendment on this bill. The amendment will be to delete this section of the statute. So we're... Your opposition, at least at this stage, is duly noted.
Thank you, sir.
Other questions?
Mr. Chair, you're talking about deleting ORS 196.840.
Yep.
Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Jeff Boatwright. Oh, excuse me, Dale Buck. Again, Mr. Buck.
Mr. Chair, John
Lilly
just took care of that one for me.
Pardon me?
Mr. Lilly and you just took care of that one for me.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Buck. I have Mr. Boatwright.
Good afternoon, Mr. Boatwright, Jeff Boatwright. I guess if it's off the table, I just wanted to mention that as far as it being a housekeeping measure, what I saw as a concern was the Oregon plan for salmon and watersheds that Governor Kitzhaber had, through Executive Order 9901, instituted. And that under that order, it had a section entitled Future Modifications, Public Involvement for Oregon Plan Generally. And then stated in there was... state agencies will make continuation or completion as appropriate for the following efforts of high priority. Listed under that, under a letter K, was DSL has proposed to adopt changes to the essential salmon habitat rules that will provide additional protection for spawning and rearing areas of Andromedus salmonids. In addition, Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife and DSL will consult with the Oregon Waters Resource Commission to determine where it is necessary to administratively close priority areas, including work under general authorizations, to fill and removal activities in order to protect salmonids. So I can see that trying to institute this stuff that was trying to implement that, I'm pretty concerned about that. Especially adding in general authorizations. So, but if it's not something that's going to be entertained, I guess there's no. I added more comments, but I'm concerned about that.
Thank you very much. I appreciate your testimony, Greg Addington.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Greg Addington. I'm with the Oregon Farm Bureau Federation. I appreciate the opportunity. And given Mr. Lilly's testimony and your comments on the bill, I would defer most of my comments to my written, for the written record. I guess I would just say that we are one of the groups that had some problems with this bill. We don't really see a problem that the bill is addressing. And as far as the housekeeping or streamlining aspect of it, our suggestion, as is in my written comments, would be to do just what the chair has suggested as far as an amendment. So we're supportive of that type of amendment and currently oppose the bill in this form.
Thank you, Mr. Redding. At this point, then, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2265, and we will move to opening work session. And the first item on the agenda is House Bill 2170, and we'll open the work session on House Bill 2170. And who do we have?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2170 is back before us for a work session. We had a public hearing on this bill on February 21st. You will recall we had folks here from the Task Force on Ballast Water Management. They had some suggestions for requesting an amendment. That amendment is before you in the Dash 1 amendments. We also have the bill also has a prior reference to Ways and Means. The amendment addresses the Ways and Means issue, and also behind your SMS you should have a copy of a fiscal statement outlining the Dash 1 amendment. And Mr. Chair, at this point we have the Department, Bob Danko of DEQ, and Mr. Sitzma here again to speak to the committee if they so choose.
Fine. Would you care to? Okay. You've heard staff with the amendments, the Dash 1 amendments.
What? Do you want me to just outline the
amendments? Yeah, that would be helpful.
Sure. As you recall, this House Bill 2170 modifies the current provisions relating to the ballast water management. It revises the definition of open sea exchange and coastal exchange, specifies that open sea and coastal exchange must occur through flow through or empty and refill exchanges, and it also extends the task force on the ballast water management until January 2005. The Dash 1 amendment deletes the reporting requirement that was in the original bill, that is section 2, which is, I'm sorry, all I have is, there it is, which were on page 1, lines 7 through 12. That was the directive to the Department of Environmental Quality for the reporting mechanism. That's been removed. Then we have some marine numbering on page 2. The other request from the task force that they ask is that on page 4, line 10, that we also include, it's on line 10.
20.
Page 4, line 20. Thank you. After that semicolon, that we specify that the north latitude and the parallel 50 degrees north latitude on the west coast of North America, that is to be in alliance with California and the other west coast states.
Otherwise, we have a situation on the other side of the ocean over in China someplace. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct.
Okay. The latitudes run all the way around the... yeah.
Okay. That's right.
Okay. The questions? Motion to adopt the Dash 1?
So moved.
Representative Jane Felder moves that the Dash 1 amendments be added to House Bill 2170. Is there any objection? So ordered.
Motion.
Motion.
Do we need a motion to rescind the referral to Ways and Means?
We can hope that that will happen, yes.
Okay. So, Mr. Chair, I move that we rescind the referral to Ways and Means for House Bill 2170 as amended with the dash one amendments and refer it to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Dingfelder moves that we pass House Bill 2170 as amended with a proviso to seek rescinding of the subsequent referral to the Ways and Means Committee. Are there any questions? Call the roll, please.
Representative Barnhart?
Aye.
Representative Brown?
Aye.
Representative Dalto, excused. Representative Tomei?
Aye.
Vice Chair Dingfelder?
Aye.
Vice Chair Cremel?
Aye.
Chair Jensen?
Aye. Chair would accept the motion.
To refer to
consent calendar?
Sure.
I so move.
Representative Brown moves that we refer this to the consent calendar. Is there any objections? Very nice. So ordered. Okay.
These are the ones I like.
No.
You delete some regulations and put in some new boundaries.
Exactly.
Okay. We'll open a work session then on House Bill 2178. And would you bring us up to date on that, Sandy?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, again, House Bill 2178 is before us today for a work session. We had a public hearing on February 16th. This is allowing a person to apply to the Water Resources Department for a permit to use stored water. It also outlines the criteria that that person must submit when applying for the stored water usage. We received, after we gaveled in today, the dash one amendments that several folks, stakeholders met. They've had a time to review it. I am passing that out to you now. If Adam, would you please? Thank you, sir.
Please, go ahead, Adam.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, for the record, Adam Sussman with the Water Resources Department. And I just want to make sure that we all remember that what this bill does is really expedite the process to obtain a permit to use stored water. And if you recall, at the testimony before this committee, there were a few issues that were raised. The stakeholders that raised those issues got together and developed these consensus amendments. The amendments do three things. Number one, they address the concerns that were raised by Water Watch of Oregon, saying basically they're in favor of going fast so long as no public interest issues have been identified. And so the bill has been amended to require a 30-day comment period, and if no public interest issues are raised by the public in those during that comment period, we can go ahead and essentially issue the permit. If public interest issues are raised, then the application would simply go into the normal process, which we believe is a good resolution of that concern. The second issue that the amendments address are the concerns raised by the Oregon Water Resources Congress that not only should there be a contract for the use of stored water, which is a current requirement, but there'd also be a notice to the operator of the reservoir, sort of in the spirit of making sure that everybody understands who's doing what with the waters of the state. And secondly, that there be also an agreement or evidence of an agreement for the entity that may be delivering that stored water. Again, the department supports those provisions. And then finally, there's some minor provisions, minor changes simply for clarification as we work through the bill to clarify what we're trying to accomplish. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes. I'm sorry, yes, I do have one other. Got so excited that the bill was moving, I forgot to mention one thing. On page 2 of the amendments, of the dash 1 amendments, page 2, line 11, there is the word owners there. We've talked with legislative council and agreed that that word should be operator or operators. If the chair was willing, we would be requesting a conceptual amendment to the dash one amendments to make that word operator.
And just as a footnote, Mr. Chair, Ledge Council said that they will accept that conceptual amendment because it's not normal for them to support making changes to an amendment, but they said that this does not appear to pose any problems, so that if the committee did want to do that at this meeting, it should be acceptable.
Thank you for rephrasing that. Specifically, what line, what word in the...
Mr. Chair, this would be in the dash one amendments, page 2, line 11. The word owners should be modified to operator.
Plural. Singular.
I believe singular.
Well, let's start this. Do we have legislative council?
Well, if owners is plural, why wouldn't you have operators plural?
Well, that's why my question.
I think for consistency, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, operators would be more consistent, yes.
Okay. Thank you. So, is there... thank you, Adam.
You're welcome.
Wait a minute. Do we have any questions for...
Mr. Chair, I do have one question. I have a feeling that this bill was heard during a time when I was not here. And my question is this in a situation, so like if you have somebody that's using the technology to basically put water back into the ground, like in a wells type situation, and then now they're wanting to pull the water back out and use it, because I notice it says for water that is stored, and that would mean something to me other than water that's, you know, just in an aquifer. Am I on the right track there, or am I like way off
base? Mr. Chair and Representative Crummell, there is a process to take water and store it in the ground, aquifer storage and recovery, and there's a whole body of law specific to that.
That's not this.
That's not what this covers, yeah. Representative Crummell.
We're basically talking about my favorite topic, aren't we? Dams.
That's correct.
Okay. some kind of little thing that, you know, will keep water from running out and being wasted.
I was unaware.
Dams do that, huh?
I was unaware, Mr. Chair, that you had an edifice complex.
Leave it to a psychiatrist to come up with that.
Thank you. I see that Legislative Council has arrived, and we will. We've got a terribly complicated question here, and we appreciate your coming. But on the dash one amendments, page 2, line 11, where it says owners, the question is whether the term should be singular or plural, operator or operators.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I would prefer to go with, so not to cause any uproar here, a singular. In that it could imply, if it's a singular, it could be more than one operator. The operator could be, if you put a plural in, the plural would then seem to imply that every reservoir would have more than one operator. I think we have a preference generally for the singular over the plural. Although there is this slight, not a conflict, but an appearance of the plural in two lines above it. That notwithstanding, and not to be held accountable for the drafting of my previous legislative councils, I think our normal form and style is singular over plural.
Okay. Do we have problems with Representative Barnard?
Well, Mr. Chair, I'm assuming that you're referring to the general principle that the singular includes the plural for in statutes.
Mr. Chair, Representative Barnard, that's correct.
Thank you.
Okay, that's fine. Thank you. Appreciate your
Mr. Chair, should we go two lines up and change that owner to operator too? I mean, as long as we're amending the law, what the hell, huh?
We can, we give us some license here, we can do all sorts of bad things, huh?
This is why legislative counsel doesn't usually want us to do this.
They don't want us drafting, right?
I'm being somewhat facetious, Mr. Chair, but it does remove the conflict that counsel is referring to. And it also eliminates the conflict of referring, on one line, referring to the operator as an owner, and the other referring to the operator as the operator. Unless I'm reading it wrong, and it's supposed to be, and it's supposed to be two different groups in that respect.
In fact, it could be, couldn't it?
Mr. Chair, Representative Crummell, that is the exact issue why this word needs to be changed. They could be the same or they could be different. And in this case, we do want to emphasize that it is the operator that we're providing notice to rather than the owner.
Well, and that's... Are you reading that correctly, though, that it should...
Yeah.
So in line 9, it should also say operator? Or
no.
Should it say owner?
It might be owners of the reservoir, but an operator or operators of... I see Mr. Kosasan wants to testify.
Not too often,
Brendan.
Mr. Chair, Representative Kummel, I think the issue is that in some cases not that the owner and the operator would not necessarily talk to one another ever, but the issue is that we want the operator to have notice from the party who's seeking to use the water, and that there may be a delay in getting that notice. This is a short term or short turnaround type of procedure, and we would want them to be notified that there was, if I'm not speaking for the department, some sort of something going on here. I think that's the reason for cutting the owner out of the loop in the second piece, because then the notice going directly to the operator lets the operator know that this is an approved use and they can go ahead and release that.
Adam, you have clarification that you want to make.
Well, Mr. Chair, I mean, the issue that the stakeholders raised is that the law has always required the applicant to work with the owner of the reservoir to obtain a contract for the delivery of the water. But sometimes the owner and operator are different entities, and so what we're trying to do, which we've done in many rulemakings over the last few years, is to make sure everybody knows who's doing what. So in this case, we want to ensure that the applicant is letting the operator know as well that they're making this application to use stored water. So that way the operator knows based on the contracting requirement and the owner knows based on the contracting requirement, and the operator knows based on the notification requirement.
Okay. Thank you. Do I hear a motion on the dash one?
Mr. Chair, I move the dash one amendments to House Bill 2178.
As conceptually amended.
Thank
you. Representative Tomei moves the dash one amendments to House Bill 2178 as conceptually amended to House Bill 2178. Is there any opposition? So ordered. Motion.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2178 as amended and conceptually amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Representative Tomei moves House Bill 2178 as amended and conceptually amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Call the roll, please.
Representative Barnhart?
Aye.
Representative Brown?
Aye.
Representative Dalto, excused. Representative Tomei?
Aye.
Vice Chair Dingfelder?
Aye.
Vice Chair Crummell?
Aye.
Chair Jensen?
Aye. And rumor has it that Representative Dingfelder would like to carry the
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
She looks ecstatic with you.
Okay.
I just suggested it.
We'll open our work session on House Bill 2186.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Again, this bill is coming to us from the Water Resources Department. We're here for a work session today. We had a public hearing on this February 16th. As you may recall, this body passed a bill in 2003. Is that right? This is right. For a pilot project that provided a provision for the department to enter into voluntary agreements with persons who wish to expedite regulatory processes. That is such a successful program that they submitted this bill, which is removing that sunset provision, which would make this a permanent project. We heard testimony from folks that have utilized this program, and they're in support of it. We do have a fiscal impact statement on this. This bill did not come to us with a referral to Ways and Means. With the fiscal impact, it will need to go to Ways and Means. This is a fiscal impact that is anticipated in the governor's budget, and you should have a fiscal impact statement behind your SMS that helps give you additional information also. And Adam is here to answer any questions that the committee might have.
He's right there.
I do have one question, Mr. Chair.
Go ahead, Representative.
With regards to the fiscal impact statement, it shows that in 2005-2007 that it actually will run about a $20,000 deficit. It's actually $19,900 and something. Can Adam explain to us why it'll run a deficit in this biennium, but then in 2007-2009 it looks as though that trend is reversed? Also, where would that $20,000 come from then?
Mr. Chair and Representative Crum, I think I'm not clear on your question yet, but maybe I can answer it a different way. I think what you're saying is that there's a difference in the bottom line revenue for 2005-2007 and 2007-2009. Is that correct?
What I'm saying is that if you look at the expenditures for 2005-2007, clarifying, Mr. Chair, if it's all right, you see $291,000 in expenditures. You see revenues of $272,518. That's a $20,000 deficit for the biennium that is coming up, 2005-2007. Now, for 2007-2009, that trend is reversed, and you are bringing in more revenues than you are expending. But my question is that if you're running a $20,000 deficit in 2005-2007, where's the money going to come from then to run this?
Chair Jensen and Representative Crum, that's a great question, and I was given a heads up on Friday that revenue number between 05 and 07 and then 07 and 09 would be different. The problem was when my understanding is that when it was calculated, whoever calculated the revenue number didn't take into account that we already had this authority all the way through January of 2006. And so they adjusted that number because I think they made an assumption that it was going to end at the end of the biennium. Okay, so they had to ratchet back that number, and in doing that, they didn't. It looks to me, I'm just guessing, Representative Crumble, that they didn't adjust the numbers in terms of the expenditure to make the two match.
In other words, there's 6 months already.
Mm-hmm.
In the approximately.
Yeah. That's correct, Mr.
In the
Chair.
Hopper. And when LC did this, they weren't recognized, or not LC, but LF did this, they weren't recognizing it.
Mr. Chair, in all humility, I suspect that's why it needs a subsequent referral.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, so again, they realized that error in terms of revenue, but didn't make this similar change up above in expenditure, because that expenditure all the way is already covered.
So, if I may, Mr. Chair, so do you think then that your revenues actually exceed the 272 would actually be closer to the, I don't mean to turn this into Ways and Means, Mr. Chair, but I'm concerned about that. So do you think that the revenues actually, that you actually receive are going to be closer to what the expenditures are as opposed to having a $20,000 deficit?
Mr. Chair, Representative Crummell, yes.
Okay. One other question, if I may, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
With regards to the department's performance measures of providing permits and services to the public, does this bill then help the department reach those goals and benchmarks?
Mr. Chair and Representative Crummell, absolutely. It's not a replacement for seeking full funding of our base programs, but it certainly helps with areas in the department where we have a workload problem. Yes, absolutely.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Question?
Call the roll, please.
We don't have a motion.
Oh, Mr. Chair. I'll take care of that.
Representative Comey.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2168 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Mm-hmm. Representative Comey moves House Bill 2186 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
It needs to go to Ways and Means.
With the subsequent
referral to Ways and Means.
Representative
Barnhart?
Aye.
Representative Brown?
Aye.
Representative
Delto excused. Representative Tomei?
Aye.
Vice Chair
Dingfelder?
Aye.
Vice Chair Crummell?
Aye.
Chair Jensen?
Aye.
House Bill 2186
has passed, and the chair will
carry the bill.
No.
Okay.
That's too bad.
Go to Ways and Means and then do it. All right. Close the work session on House Bill 2186. And with that, seeing no other agenda items, we are, in spite of being having a late start, 6 minutes early.
Well done, Mr. Chair.